How Do We Know? Part 3. The sixth talk in a series on foundations of knowing the truth was presented by Charlie Dewberry on November 19, 1991, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and some of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Dewberry's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
Okay, this is part 3 of a 3-part session, so this is going to wrap up the session called The Process of Knowing. And for those of you who are here for the first session, I outlined what I thought some of our options were when we look at epistemology. And at the end of tonight, we're going to come back to those same questions I asked at the beginning of the first session, and we're going to answer them. So in the end, that's where we're moving to. But what I'd like to do first is back up and review just a bit of last week to get us going. And then the second thing we'll talk about tonight, what I call implications of our view, or we're going to look at cases where we'll look at situations and explain why the dynamics are as they are, why things work as they do. To begin, I'll back up and review just a few definitions. The first one is belief. And in our theory, belief is an opinion that a person has, and the person supposes that that opinion corresponds to the way the world really is. So if it does correspond, it's a true belief. If it does not correspond, it's a false belief. Now, the next term was knowledge. And basically, knowledge consists of two real different definitions, if you will. The first one is, knowledge is really our true beliefs. It's knowledge is true belief. The second is, when we refer to knowledge, we are often talking about the sum total of all our true beliefs. That's what we mean by knowledge. Now, truth, the theory of truth, if you will, that we believe in this system is called the correspondence view of truth. And if you notice, I've really already used it, because when I said a belief was true or it was false, in our definitions, I commented on that a belief was true if it in fact corresponded to reality. So in this view, we hold a correspondence view of truth. The last concept that I talked about quite a bit last time was the notion of pre-understanding. And basically that concept is that whenever we come to a situation, be it where we're just seeing something or where we're talking to someone, whenever we experience something, we bring a body of all our beliefs and all our experience. We bring that body with us, and it influences greatly what we see. In fact, as we're going to see later tonight, what things mean in large part come out of the context of our whole pre-understanding. So meaning, a lot of what we mean by meaning will come by way of our pre-understanding. Now, as I mentioned last time, we personally construct all our knowledge. There are several epistemological theories that basically it believes that somehow certain things are imposed upon us from outside, that we will be forced to believe certain things, that, say, the environment may determine that we're going to believe certain kinds of things. Well, I don't believe that's true. We personally construct our knowledge, meaning that we can choose, belief by belief, what it is we're actually going to believe. Now, as I said last time, we don't consciously choose all our beliefs. In fact, most all our beliefs we subconsciously have assumed. And I used the example last time of, say, getting off the plane in a very foreign country. Well, you may notice certain things that change your view of the world. You may notice 4 or 5 or 6 of those in a day, but there's probably been 50 or 100 things that subconsciously have been tweaked in your understanding in just your experience of a day or two as you go to a foreign country. So, although we personally construct our knowledge, it isn't necessarily a conscious process. In fact, I would argue that it's largely subconscious. And then I talked a little bit about the bases for belief. And I said that there were really 3 bases for belief. One was just the notion that I want to believe it. And I think we can all think of certain situations where a person believes something and their only real justification for believing it was they wanted to believe it. I mean, it wasn't true. We were convinced it wasn't true. The second one is that it's a belief that comes out of our culture or our subculture or some aspect of our culture, that it's a belief that's taught. And there's a large number of beliefs that we have that we hold just for that reason. For example, I think all of us probably believe what we would call the Copernican view of astronomy or the Copernican view of the solar system. Well, I would like to ask you why you believe that. Have you actually sat down and gone through Ptolemy's system and gone through Copernicus's system and gone through the data and convinced yourself that Copernicus was actually right? I doubt it. You just naturally assume that Copernicus's theory is true. Why? You've just grown up and that's what you've gotten out of your educational system. The second one is when we think about what the fundamental parts of reality are, what are the fundamental aspects of reality? Well, I think everyone here believes in atoms. I think you believe that there are such things called atoms, and fundamentally that's what the world's made of. Well, why do you believe that? Quite a few philosophers throughout history have not believed that. In fact, as I pointed out a couple weeks ago, Berkeley, who was a Christian, argued that it's belief in materialistic atoms that is the foundation of modern materialistic atheistic science. And he was rejecting atoms as being a product of materialistic atheistic science. Well, have we investigated that topic? Or have we just grown up and assumed that the world's made up of atoms because that's what we're told? That's the second basis for belief. And like it or not, a tremendous number of the beliefs we hold have come from that source, that's actually the basis upon which we hold them. The last basis for belief is that reason tells us that's the way the world really is. And as I argued last time, I think it's only this basis that we really are warranted in claiming that a belief's true. That's the only acceptable warrant. Just because our culture teaches it, just because 99 out of 100 scientists tell us this is true, that's no warrant. The only warrant is reason tells us that that's the way the world really is. Now, that's not to say that we never accept authorities. Well, we do, and we have to. No person can look at more than a minutia of things. But so we're going to accept a lot of things on authority. But how is it that we're going to accept them? And I think what we need to do is we need to be consciously constructing our own view of reality and being conscious of our own view and recognizing that the beliefs we have, that all our beliefs, they need to be coherent and comprehensive. And so, for instance, as we work on our own theory, when we come up against these kinds of views, we should just run them through our current pre-understanding and say, now, is this coherent here? Does this make sense? Anyway, it's this third basis for belief, that's really the grounds upon which we ought to claim to know. Now, how does the process work? And I talked a bit about this last time, and I'd like to just quickly go through it again. And if there's any questions on this, please stop me now, because I went through pretty fast last time. So I just want to go through this portion of it. This is kind of the core. And I'd like to just go through this process and make sure it's reasonably clear before we spend most of the rest of our time talking about the application or implications of this view. Well, the process of gaining knowledge is basically that first we start with our pre-understanding. That is, we start with our worldview. We think that all that we believe now is true. Well, given our worldview, then there's certain things that we just never thought of that are going to be logically true. And so we may just start thinking about something we've never thought about before and basically say, well, yeah, that's consistent given all I believe, so I assume that this is true and I believe it. So one way that we come up with new views is or new beliefs is that way, that we just start out with what we know and we realize that an implication of what we already know is this other thing. And so we do get new beliefs that way. But every once in a while, we run across a situation which doesn't work. We run across a situation where it just doesn't turn out like we expect it will. And when that happens, we go through a process of first trying to come up with possible explanations. We've got the conclusions, but we're looking for the premises. In other words, we see this thing, whatever it is, and we know that that's the conclusion, that somehow that's real. Well, we're trying to think of ways that we could explain how this would happen. And so we'll try to think of ways to do that and to come up with possible explanations. And so when we come up with a good explanation, we may just run it through a quick test. We'll say, well, you know, if this is true, then given this situation and this situation, this ought to happen. And we might actually set up that kind of test and see if it will, see if it does in fact happen. If it does, then we accept it, and that's a new belief that we have. If we don't, we go back and continue the process. Now, as I commented on last time, sometimes we come up against bits of information that we're just unable to answer. We can't come up with any answer. It's okay to shelve those kinds of things for a while, and it's okay to accumulate a certain amount of those. But as you accumulate a great number of things that you can't explain, I think that just naturally that begins to bug you, or it ought to. And you ought to want to try to back up and try to solve this, to try to make sense out of the cases that you can't explain. Okay, so how does this theory help us? Why take the time? Why take this last couple weeks to try to do this process? What could we possibly gain from doing this? Well, first, I think that like it or not, subconsciously, we've all developed a theory like this. Now, your theory might look quite different from mine when you think about it from classes you've taken or else thinking about it yourself. You may have developed a very different epistemology. And so, given your different view, we have to see if an alternate view or our own view, we have to see if our own view makes sense out of the world and it makes sense out of what we see. And if it does, then it'll actually help us when we hit situations where we aren't sure if it can be answered or if we aren't sure how to answer it. So first, this theory, I think, helps us explain how we know things in the world. For example, the process we just went through in number two, how we gain knowledge, I think that's kind of how we do it day in, day out. I think that's how we live our lives. I think that's a process by which we've come to know everything just in our everyday life. Or I would argue that that's the same method by which a scientist comes to what he knows, that there is no unique scientific method, that this is what every scientist is actually doing. So how we know the world is simply this process I outlined. Now, what are the implications of our theory, then, for knowing things in the world? Well, the first one is, we always start with our pre-understanding, and let's say these are elements of our pre-understanding, and we believe they're true. Well, our difficulty is if one of these is not true, then we can end up seeing it a different way than it actually is. And so the fact that we have pre-understanding, and the fact that we have to recognize that parts of our pre-understanding might be false, that causes us to be, I think, a little bit more humble when it comes to living life. And I find that as I live life, I'm surprised more and more and more how many things I've had in here I believe that I've jettisoned as life goes on. It's amazing to me things that there was no way I thought could be questioned. I no longer believe anymore. So how we look at the world is dependent on our beliefs we bring to it. And if we've got something wrong with what we believe and what we bring to it, we may see something different from how it actually is. I think just a simple case of that is maybe the lightning example I mentioned last time. Well, I, for years and years, had only seen lightning go from the air to the ground. I'd sat and watched lightning up in the clouds, and every once in a while I'd see it hit the ground. But I had never actually seen it go from the ground to the air until I was backpacking, and, you know, a physicist pointed out to me that it actually could. And he'd been standing there watching it go from the ground to the air for half an hour, and I'd always seen it go the other way. But once he pointed out it was a possibility, I saw it for the first time. Simple little example, but I think that happens to us a lot in life. That, and that's the second part, that our pre-understanding, it's the most reasonable. Why it has such an impact on us is it's so reasonable, because we think it's right. And so until it's challenged, we're just naturally going to use it, and it's going to greatly impact, for instance, what we see. But where this view differs from a lot of other epistemologies is that this view doesn't determine what you can see. You can imagine other positions, like I imagined, well, yeah, let me think. Is it possible lightning could go from the ground to the air? Well, I guess so in physics. And then I instantly saw it go the other way. Now, it's interesting to me that sometimes people have been on trips with me in the mountains and will look at the lightning. And some people just cannot and will not see lightning go the other way, because it doesn't. And that brings up, I think, another important aspect of this view. And it's related again to the basis of belief. And that is that there are certain situations, whether we're conscious of them or not, that we want to believe something to be true. Part of that will naturally come out of rebellion. That it's part of our rebellious nature that there's certain kinds of things we're just going to be pretty reluctant to believe, just because we don't want to. And so our motivation for our desires, our motivation, can really influence even what we see in the world. And so this is another portion of the dynamics now that's part of our lives as we deal with, as we live our lives day to day, we have to deal with this fact that there are certain things we just want to believe are true, and at times we'll go to quite great lengths to see them that way and not admit that they could be otherwise. So that's a major part of the dynamic of how we know things in the world. The second thing is, and this one, actually, seeing things in the world is incredibly simple and straightforward compared to the second one. The second one I've lumped under what I would call conversation or communication. Now, if you think we can go wrong with just seeing things in the world, that's incredibly simple compared to communication. And I think we all have experienced that. There are times where we are hard-pressed. There are times where I'm hard-pressed, at least, to think communication can work. There are times where I've spent an incredible amount of time trying to communicate something to somebody, and they just don't get it. And there are times where people have been trying very, very hard to say something to me, and I just don't hear it. And the other person can't understand how in the world it is that I don't get it. Well, I think that conversation here works the same basic way as seeing does, in the sense that our pre-understanding is involved, and it's a two-stage process rather than just one. So what I'd like to do is just diagram this for just a second. So with regards to seeing something in nature, and I'm not quite the artist Wes is, so you'll have to bear with me. But for instance, seeing, say, let's call them a couple trees. Maybe I should label them, right? Right? Trees. Okay, and this is a person over here. One person may look at these two trees and say, well, they're the same kind of tree. And somebody else might look at it and say, well, no, wait a minute, those are two different kinds of trees. And so we can see from what I've said how we would get into this kind of thing. Two people could look at two trees, and either they'd see them as the same kind or different kinds. And what's at stake is their pre-understanding. Okay, well, if we're now just looking at a person and their pre-understanding and whether they see one tree or two, we can see that's fairly straightforward and fairly simple. That's what we've been talking about for a while. But now when we come over here, we have two trees and now two people, and now this person is telling this person that there's two trees there, two kinds of trees. Well, what we have here now is a much more complicated situation in this. And just to give you an idea of the added dimension that's complicated in here, the added dimension that's complicated is the dynamics of language. And I just want to give you a quick example to show you how pre-understanding will affect how you understand language. For example, I say to you, that's a strike and that's good. True or false? It's a strike and that's good. True or false? My hunch is you can't answer it because you can think of cases where it might be true and there's cases it might be false. So let's say I'm not talking about bowling, I'm talking about baseball. So does that help you? And the answer is, well, not really, because I might be the pitcher or I might be the batter. Well, I'll tell you it's the pitcher. Well, is that a strike? A strike is good, true or false? That's a strike and that's good, true or false? Is that true then? And does it make sense to you? And it should, that if it's a pitcher and it's a strike, that makes perfect sense. And that's good from his perspective. But actually, I'm doing something else. I was referring to a labor strike, and the pitcher is the labor mediator. So see, the point is, all of the pre-understanding, you need all the pieces of pre-understanding that the other person has in order to understand what's meant. You've got to have it all. If you're missing one little piece, it can make all the difference in the world. And that's the way language works. And that's the way reason we have such a hard time with language is you can hear all the words okay, but when person B hears all the words that person A says, person B is putting them into their own pre-understanding. Now the problem with this is if the pre-understanding differs anywhere, then you may hear radically different things. So whenever we have communication, in order for it to actually work, person B has to put themselves into person A's head and understand what person A is talking about in order to hear what they're saying. And then if person B can actually do that, which, you know, that's a discussion all in itself, but I think we can. We acknowledge that it's possible. I think we would have to acknowledge that it's often very difficult to do. But if you can, then when person B says, no, well, I don't think you're right about that, that there's actually only one kind of tree over here, let's say, that when B says something back to A, A's got to do the same thing. A's got to be able to imagine being in B's head and saying, now, wait a minute, where's B coming from? What's all the context? What's all the beliefs here, the pre-understanding that B's bringing to that comment? Now, what I would argue is that actually, as complex as that process is, we do it all the time. Because if we didn't, we wouldn't make sense out of anything anybody ever said. But I would also say that in large part, that to a large extent, we aren't as careful about doing it as we ought to. And I think, at least in my case, I have N number of conversations where I didn't listen as close as I should have. And knowing what I know, that's how important listening is. And listening is a very active kind of process. And so when B hears the words that A says, it's not just listening to the words, but it's getting inside A's head. B has to get inside A's head and think of it from that perspective in order to really track. Quite often when we're talking with someone, we'll just be talking along and everything's going along, and all of a sudden you say, whoa, wait a minute. I was tracking with you fine here, but then I just kind of lost it. Well, see, it's at those points when we stop conversations, when it doesn't track, those are the times where either the person was tracking along, going along okay, and then just kind of went weird. Either the person really went weird, which happens, you know, when I talk to a lot of people, they just get weird and it doesn't follow. But the other possibility is they actually were tracking real just fine, but it's just you weren't getting what they were actually trying to communicate. But it's at these points in our interactions with people that we stop them, that we realize something's going wrong with the process here. And it's at these times where, if you think about it, that when you stop in your communication and say, now, wait a minute, how does that make sense? You just made a big left turn here. I don't get how this follows at all. what you're really asking the other person to do, really, is come back over here and fill in this blank and see where the difference is. Because they probably went straight through, and you maybe not. But now, it isn't always the case. Sometimes they do, in fact, make a left turn. But the point is, the process ended there. Because the only way you have of knowing if wavelength with someone is if you're really tracking along with them, if what they're saying makes sense, given the way you're hearing it and the way you hear it through your pre-understanding. So that's the way communication works. And it's, at times, a difficult process to do. But we all know it works. That, in fact, it can and it does work. But it takes a great deal of attention sometimes for it to work. So that really has a lot of implications for us. For a couple reasons I'll just mention. The first one I've already talked about is an oral, say, conversation. Well, looking at the example, the meanings of words. The meanings of words we use are going to be dependent on pre-understanding. Secondly, when we come to determining the meaning of written words, like, for example, in the Bible, the same process exactly pertains. In order to understand what a person is writing, we also have to put ourselves in their minds. We have to look at the world as they looked at it in order to really understand what meaning they're driving at. And what we have a tendency to do is we read the words, but we read it in our pre-understanding. The difficulty is setting aside our pre-understanding and reconstruct what their pre-understanding is. We need to get in their heads. And I think that's probably the most difficult thing to do when it comes to reading texts, because reading texts is even harder than conversations with people. The reason is you just can't interact the same way. When you're talking to a person and it just kind of goes weird, you can stop them and say, hey, wait a minute, either you just slipped a cog here or else I'm missing something because this just doesn't make sense. Well, you can actually dialogue and you can sort out the pre-understandings that you bring to it. But when you're dealing with a written text, that's not as easy. In fact, it's more or less mostly on you, because the only way you can interact with the person in a written text is through what they wrote. So it means that reading is a very difficult kind of process if it's difficult writing. And so I think that explains a lot of the problems that throughout, say, the history of the church, of why there's been so many different interpretations of the Bible, why there's been so many disagreements, is because reading and dealing with a text is very difficult because of this process, the different pre-understandings that are brought to the text. The second thing I'd like to point out as far as an application is, given that we believe this is true, that this view is true, or at least I hope I've convinced a few of you that at least this has got some plausibility. Let's say two people are interacting. Let's say you're doing evangelism. And so you walk up to somebody and you say, Jesus is Lord. He died for your sins. And the person goes, huh, you know, I've never been a Christian, but son of a gun. That makes perfect sense to me. Yeah, I'll believe that. If you think about it, given the process that we've outlined on the board, that doesn't make sense. Because we're always going to hear what's spoken to us given our own perspective. And so when that kind of a presentation is made to a person, how are they expected to hear it? Well, they're going to hear it through their own pre-understanding, because that's all they've got to work with. And so if a person isn't exactly set up to immediately hear this, then how could they possibly understand? And secondly, given that we all believe that our pre-understanding is true, then how would we expect that situation to cause them to give up all that they believe is true? Just that simple statement. It strikes me that we need to think as an implication, epistemology is true, that really does have some implication for how we deal with other people. And how we, for instance, try to take the gospel and basically even communicate it to somebody else. How can we do that? Because the only way for communication to take place is for both people to be able to track with the other person's pre-understanding. Otherwise, communication doesn't really take place. And so that, I think, is the real challenge for us. Is, on one hand, we are a product of 20th century culture. I mean, we live in it. We speak English, we use words, we can interact with everybody on campus just fine. But yet when it comes to Christianity, that's a part of our pre-understanding that we have that the other people don't. And so what we really have to emphasize and build on as we interact with other people is first the common ground of our common life experience. Because what I think you're looking for are places where their pre-understanding doesn't explain all there is to life. And so it strikes me that given this kind of view, that when we think about interacting with people who hold quite different views, that we really need to be careful to consider what they can really hear and what we have in common that we can dialogue with, and then how we can present what we want to say in such a way that they can actually hear it. Okay, the last thing I'd like to talk just a little bit about then is where this theory fits within epistemology. Now, I'd like to make just a couple comments about why I even think this is worth doing. Well, and there's a couple reasons. One, for people who have some background in epistemology, who already kind of have the boxes that you can just stuff things in, it makes an kind of an easy way to describe what the position is. But secondly, most of these issues, I think, in one way or another, you're going to run into over time. And I think that just learning the very rudimentary, very simple containers that philosophy uses to box these concepts, you'll be able to pick out where you differ with somebody else and what that difference is very quickly. So I'd like to come back then to those first four questions I raised in the first lecture and answer them now. The first question I ask is, can we know? Well, I've argued that we can answer a skeptic, that we do have a way of answering a skeptic. Now, there's lots of different kinds of skeptics, and so it would be impossible to stand here and give all the skeptical arguments that have been raised over time. But the majority of the skeptical arguments that have been raised over time, like, for instance, can you know anything? How do you know that you live in a three-dimensional physical world? Well, I think those skeptics can be answered, those kinds of skeptics. I think you can claim to know the world as it really is. And we could talk about that if you want to talk about some of the varieties, and I don't know all that many, but some of the basic skeptical arguments that have been raised over time, I think can be addressed, and you can dialogue and you can answer them. Second, how do we know? Well, remember, we had a few different options here. One was empiricism. So, for example, when we think of empirical science, well, empirical science holds an empirical view of how we know. That is, all we know from experience. What I'm claiming is, how we know is a form of rationalism. That is, we have certain built-in beliefs that we hold, that we have, that we didn't get, that ultimately aren't grounded in experience. They didn't arise from the data of our five major senses. There are certain kinds of beliefs like that. For example, the notion that I exist. So, for example, sometimes you get into the philosophical debates in epistemology with people, and their first thing is, well, wait a minute. I mean, come on, how do you know you really exist? Give me a proof of that. Yeah, I mean, how do you really know you exist? What are you going to give me? Data of your five major senses? Well, that's not going to work. See, you can't give me any experience because you can't step outside yourself and experience yourself apart from being you. So you couldn't possibly have any empirical experience. So how can you possibly claim to know you exist? Well, see, that kind of question is raised by an empiricist who is skeptical that you can know because you can't give a warrant. You can't give the warrant of experience. You can't give them experiential data that you exist. There's no data you could give them that would convince them. And so what you have to really say is basically the belief that I exist, that's a fundamental built-in belief. And if a person is really struggling with that question, you might suggest that they go down to the Johnson unit and see if they can be helped down there. Because if a person is really questioning whether they exist or not, that's really pathological. It's either pathological or silly, one of the two. And that's the kind of argument I would make against that kind of position, is it's either insane or it's pathologically destructive. So, the view we hold is a form of rationalism. Second, how do we perceive the external world? And the view that at least I hold, I don't know if everybody around here does or not, but it's basically called common sense realism. And according to common sense realism, we believe that there is a three-dimensional world out there that's independent of minds, independent of our thinking of it or our being conscious of it, that we really can know. And as I say, that's a real simple description of common sense realism. The last question that I raised was how beliefs are justified. And the two options here, if you remember, were coherence and foundationalism. And what I've been arguing is that the view that we hold is foundational. It's a justification based on foundations. And the foundations are those common sense beliefs that are hardwired in. Those form the basis upon which all the rest of our belief system is built. And what I've been arguing is those foundational beliefs are all hardwired in, that every human being has those, and they were built into us by God. So it's by the nature of our constitution that we have these beliefs. Well, anyway, that ends the presentation, so I'll take questions for a few minutes, and then we can wrap it up. Yeah.
Would you say then that these hardwired beliefs, if they should point to God, how would you explain to someone who says, oh no, there is no God, that some in between they're communicating their conscious understanding of this thought, there is no God, that they've got some cultural or some beliefs based on, well, maybe some out of rebellion, sort of an intermediate layer that filters these foundational beliefs so that at the conscious level, they don't see that
okay.
Actually they're in error, that they're speaking.
Well, let me ask a couple of things first. Where are you claiming belief in God would be? Are you claiming that would be a foundational belief, or are you claiming it would be up here?
Well, I'm claiming that the foundational beliefs would point you to that.
Okay, yeah, I think in the end they do. The way they point, or at least one way they point, is this. And that is, if you take your theory of knowledge and ask the question, how is it that we can know a world? How is it that our rationality corresponds to the rationality of nature or of the world? Okay, see, this will turn out, I think, to be a very key question, because a lot of theories are going to say, well, you just can't know. Well, the problem is that's inconsistent, because we do really think we know. The second option is naturalism. Naturalism claims, well, our rationality corresponds to the rationality of nature, because it just does. Okay? Well, lastly, a Christian can say, well, our rationality corresponds to the rationality of nature because God is rational, and He made these two things, and that's why it works. So in the end, what I'm saying is, fundamentally, one of the ways that a foundationalist argument like that would point to God would be through this kind of argument, is because no other theory of knowledge can adequately explain how this works. That's a fundamental flaw of every other theory. Now, see, what I would argue is it's only this kind of way, well, I'm not going to say only, but I think it's primarily this kind of way that kind of argument, that you can get to an argument about God if the person is sophisticated and wants to talk about epistemology. Now, I don't know if that's actually what you intended, but what I want to say is if there's epistemological differences, this is ultimately where you're going to come.
You know, those things you've got in circles there, are those foundational?
Yeah. Well, rationality, sure.
Okay. What I'm saying is they've got that, but it's mm-hmm. At some higher level, where we find they're communicating, mm-hmm. they don't come up with the same answer.
Right.
What has intervened?
Well,
in that different view, even though we're...
Two things.
The same
yeah.
Places.
Two things. Well, one could just flat out be rebellion, and that's likely. But the other one is the person's pre-understanding that they're bringing to this is, at this point, is, well, okay, right now I'm a naturalist. I've got this far. I agree with you. There's rationality in the world, and I agree that there's rationality in nature and we can know it. I agree with that. But, well, you say God's a possibility. Well, God's a possibility, but I'm not convinced I've exhausted all the possibilities here. I don't think it's really true that I somehow can't find another answer for this. Now, is that a reasonable reply? And I guess I would say that it's not an unreasonable reply for a point in time. There may. I don't think so. But there might be some way to answer this. I'm not aware of it, and I don't think so. So from my perspective, the Christian view is the only one that can really answer this successfully. But see, for the person to acknowledge that, well, I agree with you here, but I'm not convinced yet that that's the only answer. Is that a reasonable answer? And I would say at a point in time, yeah, that's a reasonable answer. Okay, is that getting at your question? Okay, well, I wanted to keep it in epistemology. Anything else?
We can use our faith to get beyond that. There is any conflict in the rationality of nature level. I think the faith would carry us to the goal.
Yeah, that's actually a very good point. Something I should make a few comments on is how exactly our faith fits into this. And the way I see faith fitting into this is faith is basically our, at least in my own dynamic, I find that my faith in God and my faith and trust that our view is right is foundationally very, very intimately related to the extent to which I think what I hold, the Christian worldview, is true. So faith, I think, is really wrapped up in the notion of a commitment to what's really true, and that fundamentally with regards to epistemology, that our faith is really wrapped up in this process, and that it's our faith, it's our commitment to pursue truth that really is a fundamental dynamic in the process. The opposite of that, of course, would be a rebellion that you would rebel against.
It's part of being obedient.
It's our commitment to...
Commitment.
Yeah, it's our commitment to pursue what we believe is true in the world, yeah.
Yeah. I missed something when you were explaining there.
Okay.
How are you defining the rationality, the first circle, that's human rationality?
Yeah, that's human rationality. Things like logic, the way, you know, our logic works, that given A, given B, then this would be true.
And rationality of nature is... Well, the things work in an orderly manner? Or?
Well, what I'm claiming is they work in the same rational manner as this. That's the claim I'm making.
But you're saying that there are some epistemologies that think they work differently?
Well, there's some that deny it's rational at all. Some just claim that we impose on a random system.
Oh, you're not questioning whether or not nature is rational and we're rational. The other epistemologists insist that the question is how that can be so.
Well, I think there's two things, actually. One is, the debate between Christians and naturalists. Naturalists would say the same thing, that we have rationality and our rationality is the same that corresponds to nature, because if that isn't true, then we can't claim to know anything. Well, those are two worldviews that agree on this. Now, there's a lot of other worldviews that don't. Nihilism, existentialism. An existentialist would say, well, rationality in nature? There's nothing there. You create it. So most of the rest of the systems deny that you actually can know. And the reason they deny you can actually know things in nature is because they look at this problem and say, well, yeah, we could never be sure that our rationality corresponded to the rationality of nature. We could never know that.
So they'd see them both as being rational, but maybe not having the same rationality.
No, they would not see them both as rational. So in other words, in fact, well, like I say, take at least some forms of existentialism. It's just atoms in motion out here. It's just random. Well, that's not rational in the sense of having an order. What you're doing is you as a human being, and you'll call rational whatever you do. I mean, it might be wearing green glasses. I'll wear green glasses. Well, I'm going to see the world as green. It isn't green, but that doesn't matter. I just make it green. So, and there's a lot of philosophies. In fact, probably the majority that come to this point and think, well, from the time of Kant, that's in fact one of the things Kant believed, is that we see the world as green because we wear green glasses. Now, we don't know how the world really is. We can't know how the world really is. But we call it green because that's the way we see it. But there's no way we could know how it really is. And so there's a very large number of philosophical views that just don't believe we could know this. Okay? And so actually raising both parts of this. But I do need to stop here, I think. Does that make sense to you now? Okay.